This is your daily news fix, the Daily Brief, right here on RCR.
Good afternoon, it's Monday, February 3rd, and you're listening to the RCR Daily Brief, your roundup of the day's biggest news. I'm Megan McNamara, and here's what we have lined up for you today. Bringing us the latest headlines, we've got Paul Brennan with the news. RCR political analyst William McGimpsey will join us for some political insights before RCR commentator Peter Williams joins us to talk about the latest climate madness. Then Natalie Cutler-Welsh is here for RCR Signpost, bringing us the latest on new interviews dropping, key campaigns, and how you can take action. Let's get into it.
Good afternoon. Phase two of the COVID-19 inquiry has begun to call for public submissions. The inquiry, negotiated into the coalition agreement by New Zealand First, will cover controversial topics omitted from phase one. Key areas under review include vaccine mandates, vaccine approval, and safety. It will also examine lockdowns and assess the effectiveness of rapid antigen tests, testing, and tracing. Phase one of the inquiry, led by Commissioner Tony Blakely, found that while early COVID-19 measures were justified, later mandates and lockdowns caused significant harm. In other New Zealand news, US Senator Ted Cruz faced backlash for reposting a misleading news article from Israeli newspaper Haaretz. The story falsely claimed that every Israeli must disclose their military service when applying for a visitor visa to New Zealand. Foreign Minister Winston Peters has requested New Zealand diplomats in the US clarify the government's position. The government has announced a second climate target under the Paris Agreement, aiming to reduce emissions by between 51 and 55% compared to 2005 levels by 2035. Federated farmers criticised the target, warning that it ignored the government's own independent climate review. Resources Minister Shane Jones outlined plans to increase the value of mineral exports to $3 billion annually, up from $2 billion. In his speech, Jones also criticised banks that refused to finance fossil fuel projects, blaming the UN for fostering a malevolent cult that believes it can control the weather. Former ACT Party President Tim Jago has had his name suppression lifted on 8 counts of indecently assaulting 2 teenagers he'd been mentoring through a sports club between 1995 and 1999. ACT leader David Seymour reportedly knew of the allegations 3 months before Jago resigned. Turning to international news, the US has announced new tariffs imposing 10% on China, 25% on Mexico, and 25% on Canadian goods. The Trump administration said the measures against China were in response to illegal fentanyl exports that have killed millions of Americans. In response, Canada announced plans for a new 25% tariff on some U.S. goods, while Mexico said it would also retaliate with tariff and non-tariff measures. The UK Labour government is under fire over plans to weaken border laws by repealing key Conservative-era immigration measures. The Home Office is reportedly scrapping rules that prevent illegal migrants from gaining settled status and removing provisions that allow authorities to classify asylum seekers as adults if they refuse age checks. Conservative MP Chris Philip warned the approach could turn Britain into the soft touch of Europe. The Trump administration has signed an executive order to combat anti-Semitism on university campuses, pledging to deport resident aliens involved in pro-Palestine protests. The order followed a wave of demonstrations against Israel's military campaign in Gaza. About 2,000 students have been arrested in the US for participating in pro-Palestine protests.
Now for a closer look at a diplomatic debacle that unfolded on social media over the weekend. Here's William.
Thanks, Megan. John Minto's genocide hotline now appears to have caused a diplomatic incident between New Zealand and the United States. The latest developments are that Israeli newspaper Haaretz published a fake news story that incorrectly asserted that every Israeli must detail their military service to our immigration department in order to receive a visitor's visa to enter New Zealand. Texas Senator Ted Cruz has retweeted the story, blasting New Zealand for, quote, unquote, denigrating and punishing Israeli citizens. Foreign Minister Winston Peters has tweeted back, saying that the Haaretz story is false and that the New Zealand government has condemned Minto's hotline. The Hareid story was subsequently withdrawn, and Kiwi diplomats are scrambling to contact Senator Cruz to explain the New Zealand government's position to him. What John Minto is doing is certainly a bit iffy. Personally identifying IDF members does have a vague air of intimidation about it, but it is not illegal, and Minto, as a New Zealand citizen, has the right to free speech. That is what should take priority. But another important point is that what John Minto is doing is very similar to what the Jewish lobby does to anyone who says anything that can be remotely construed as anti-Semitic. That is, dox or publicly highlight the speech in a way that is vaguely threatening and brings personal costs to bear on the speaker. If you consider what John Minto is doing to be threatening, intimidating, or contrary to human rights, then so is the behaviour of the Jewish lobby. But I think we can go even deeper here. According to the APAC Tracker website, Ted Cruz has received $1.7 million from the pro-Israel lobby. I refuse to believe that they hand out this money while expecting nothing in return. Could it be that Cruz has been asked by APAC to put out that tweet in order to publicly embarrass the New Zealand government and put pressure on us over the John Minto situation? My main concern here, however, is the effect this sort of soft policing of people's speech has on our free speech culture over time. Sometimes it is reasonable to criticise or even just discuss the behaviour of groups, be they ethnic groups, religious groups, nations, etc. And the constant use of woke speech policing terms like racist, anti-Semite, Islamophobe, etc. creates a culture where people are reluctant, in aggregate, to discuss these issues, for fear that some group or another might decide that it is quote-unquote offensive and personally target them for it. This might seem like no big deal on the surface, but over time, this soft speech policing mechanism has had devastating results across Western institutions and society, making it impossible to tackle important issues around race, sex, sexuality, or religion, and leading to good people having their reputations and careers destroyed for trying. These taboos are the origin of cancel culture and the woke mob, and as long as they persist, they will have negative effects in our society. The government's decision last week to sign New Zealand up for even tougher climate targets than the previous government did is receiving some nasty backlash online, particularly these incendiary comments from Prime Minister Christopher Luxon. Let's take a listen.
Oh, look, I mean, you can't be living in the 21st century and deny that human-induced climate change is real. It is real. There's no room for climate deniers or climate minimalists in the 21st century, I just put it to you. That's why the national government signed New Zealand up to the Paris Agreement. It's why we're deeply committed to net carbon zero 2050.
Back to you, Megan.
Thanks for those insights, William. Now let's hear what RCR commentator Peter Williams has to say about the new climate commitments we've all been signed up to.
Back in the times I don't really want to remember, that was when Jacinda Ardern was the Prime Minister. She had this thing called the Prime Minister's Business Advisory Council. I don't know what it ever achieved. Probably not much. But the chair of it, through a personal invitation, was a guy called Christopher Luxon. At the time, he was the CEO of Air New Zealand. Now, what that told us then, and this was just 7 years ago, remember? It told us that Luxon and Ardern were not unsympathetic to each other's ideology on life. And we saw a modern-day personification of that with last Thursday's announcement by Christopher Luxon's National Party-led coalition government that this country is heading towards economic suicide with its ludicrous greenhouse gas emissions targets on the way to some mythical status of net zero in 25 years' time. The first targets are to halve our 2005 emissions in just 5 years. That's impossible. Half our emissions come from agriculture. What the National Party is signing us up for is to reduce the size of our dairy cow herd, and it's been reducing anyway since hitting 6.7 million in 2014. The latest number is 5.92 million in June of last year. If the herd has reduced 11% in the last decade, then surely so have the emissions. So for New Zealand to reach these unrealistic targets, we either have to cull the herd even more, and the reduction since 2014 has been about increasing efficiency in our largest export industry, or we have to take thousands of hectares of productive land and plant them in pine trees, or we have to buy carbon credits on the world market at a cost estimated by Treasury to be $24 billion over the next 5 years. Now, this is the sort of madness put about by the looniest, left-wing, most farmer-hating government in this country's existence. That was one led by that woman, and her CV-altering Environment Minister James Shaw. The National Party in opposition said they wouldn't have agriculture in our emissions reduction regime. Now they've reneged, and they're making life down on the farm as difficult as it ever was under the Marxists of the last government. The National Party, and in particular its leader, just cannot see what's going on in the world. Do they not know Donald Trump taking the US out of the Paris Climate Accord? Do they not see China and India continuing to become more industrialised through increased coal-powered energy production? And do they not see the world gradually coming to the realisation that the planet is neither burning up, freezing over, or being washed away? And if the climate is changing, it's a gradual thing that we will all have plenty of time to adapt to, and that frankly, what humanity does to try and stop it will have little to no impact at all. If you doubt the veracity of that, read the Danish economist Bjorn Lomborg's analysis and weep at the money that affluent nations are just throwing in the wind. And getting back to this country, remember that New Zealand is responsible for just 0.17% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions. That's right, 0.17%. And what we do to reduce emissions will not make the slightest difference to the world's climate or to our weather next week, next year, next decade, or next century. We are wasting our time and money setting nonsensical CO2 emissions reductions targets. Christopher Luxon made a big speech one day not so long back about powering economic growth. And then he and his climate change minister, Simon Watts, come up with this nonsense. The best way possible to stunt economic growth surely is by giving away $24 billion. The man should have stayed joined at the hip to Jacinda Ardern all those years ago and become a Labour Party politician. That's where his natural home seems to be. And then we might all have been saved from this nonsense.
Thanks, Peter. That certainly gives us something to think about. Now let's pivot. There's always a lot going on at RCR that we want you to know about, so you can keep your finger on the pulse and get involved. Natalie joins us now to give us the details.
Thanks, Megan. Great to be here for The Signpost, where we bring you the latest interviews, insights, and key updates you won't want to miss. First up, dropping on the app today, Rodney Hyde and Elizabeth Cave dive into the shifting landscape of education and society. They discuss their experiences with military training programs, the shift from philosophy to psychology in education, and growing concerns about mental health education in schools. They examine how training manuals shape teachers' beliefs, the impact of a hyper-focus on gender, sexuality, and race, and the role of social media in driving these issues. It's a fascinating and thought-provoking conversation. Definitely check that one out. Meanwhile, I had the pleasure yesterday of catching up with tons of concerned Kiwis at the Michael Connett event all about fluoride. RCR roving reporter Tane Webster was on the ground at the Auckland event catching up with U.S. Attorney Michael Connett. And Michael has spent the last 7 years locked in a legal battle with the EPA over fluoride. And he's here in New Zealand to share what he's uncovered. Let's hear a clip from Michael now.
What would you say to New Zealand's Prime Minister or Minister of Health if they came to you to get your perspective on fluoridation of water?
It's not about whether you're pro-fluoride or anti-fluoride. It's about how can you use fluoride in a way that doesn't pose unnecessary risks to people. And so when you're adding fluoride to water, that's what you are doing. You are imposing upon people who don't want to ingest fluoride a risk that is unnecessary, and an unnecessary risk is an unacceptable one. And fluoride is now available in many topical forms like toothpaste. Toothpaste is readily available at every grocery store you can go to. It's not expensive. Mm-hmm. And with toothpaste, you apply the fluoride to the teeth and you spit it out. And that's a rational way of using fluoride. And we really should be moving away from this sort of mass fluoridation paradigm where we are compelling people to ingest it every day through something like water. And that does carry risk.
It was such a fascinating talk, predominantly about his journey and all of the roadblocks along the way, as well as what he has found. And it's information that every Kiwi, I feel, should have access to. So if you missed the talk, don't worry. You can hear the key takeaways in today's interview. And also make sure you check Fluoride Free NZ for an event near you. And finally, phase two of the COVID inquiry is now underway. The Royal Commission is calling for Kiwis to share their personal experiences via the online portal. And tonight, we're unpacking exactly what this means in a special webinar. Joining the conversation will be RCR co-founder Alia Bland, lawyer Katie Ashby-Coppins, the Health Forum's Linda Wharton, and everybody's favorite scientist, Guy Hatchard. Find out what this next phase involves and how you can make sure that your voice is heard. To register, just check the link in the show notes. That's it for me today. Megan, back to you.
Thanks, Natalie. For all the links we mentioned in today's show, be sure to check out the show notes at the bottom of the episode. And that wraps up today's RCR Daily Brief. Thanks for tuning in. Have a fantastic day, and we'll catch you tomorrow with another edition of the show. Until then, see ya.